This one also had a rift in the ceiling, and faint sunlight trickled down. A squad of 10 soldiers stood guard in the room, and they snapped to attention as soon as Ham entered. Kelsier nodded approvingly.
10 men at all times?
At each of the 3 entrances, Ham said.
Good, Kelsier said.
He walked forward, inspecting the soldiers. He wore his sleeves up, his scars showing, and he could see the men eyeing them. He didn't really know what to inspect, but he tried to look discriminating. He examined their weapons, staves for 8 of the men, swords for 2, and dusted off a few shoulders, though none of the men wore uniforms. Finally, he turned to a soldier, who bore an insignia on his shoulder.
"Who do you let out of the cavern, soldier?"
"Only men bearing a letter sealed by General Hammond himself, sir."
"No exceptions?"
Kelsier asked.
"No, sir."
"And if I wanted to leave right now?"
The man paused.
"You'd stop me," Kelsier said. "No one is exempt, soldier. Not me, not your bunkmate, not an officer, no one. If they don't have that seal, they don't leave."
"Yes, sir,"
the soldier said.
"Good man," Kelsier said. "If all of your soldiers are this fine, General, then the Lord Ruler has good reason to be afraid."
The soldiers puffed up slightly at the words.
"Carry on, men," Kelsier said, waving for Ham to follow as he left the room.
"That was kind of you," Ham said softly. "They've been anticipating your visit for weeks."
Kelsier shrugged.
"I just wanted to see that they were guarding the crack properly. Now that you have more men, I want you to post guards at any tunnels leading to these exit caverns."
Ham nodded.
"Seems a bit extreme, though."
"Humor me," Kelsier said. "A single runaway or malcontent could betray us all to the Lord Ruler. It's nice that you feel you could defend this place, but if there's an army camped outside trapping you in, this army will effectively become useless to us."
"All right," Ham said. "You want to see the 3rd entrance?"
"Please," Kelsier said.
Ham nodded, leading him down another tunnel.
"Oh, one other thing," Kelsier said after a bit of walking. "Get together groups of 100 men, all ones you trust, to go tromp around up in the forest. If someone comes looking for us, we won't be able to hide the fact that lots of people have passed through the area. However, we might be able to muddle the tracks so much that the trails all lead nowhere."
"Good idea."
"I'm full of them," Kelsier said as they stepped into another cave chamber, this one far larger than the previous two. It wasn't an entrance rift, but instead a practice room. Groups of men stood with swords or staves, sparring beneath the eye of uniformed instructors. Uniforms for the officers had been Doxson's idea. They couldn't afford to outfit all the men. It would be too expensive, and obtaining that many uniforms would look suspicious. However, maybe seeing their leaders in uniform would help give the men a sense of cohesion. Ham paused at the edge of the room, rather than continuing onward. He eyed the soldiers, speaking softly.
"We need to talk about this sometime, Kel. The men are starting to feel like soldiers, but... well, they're scar. They've spent their lives working in mills or fields. I don't know how well they'll do when we actually get them onto a battlefield."
"If we do everything right, they won't have to do much fighting," Kelsier said.
"The pits are only guarded by a couple 100 soldiers. The Lord Ruler can't have too many men there, lest he hint at the location's importance. Our 1,000 men can take the pits with ease, then retreat as soon as the garrison arrives. The other 9,000 might have to face a few Great House Guard squads and the palace soldiers. But our men should have the upper hand in numbers."
Ham nodded, though his eyes still seemed uncertain.
"What?"
Kelsier asked, leaning against the smooth, crystalline mouth of the cavern juncture.
"And when we're done with them, Kel?"
Ham asked.
"Once we have our ATM, we give the city and the army over to Yeadon. Then what?"
"That's up to Yeadon," Kelsier said.
"They'll be slaughtered," Ham said very softly. 10,000 men can't hold Luthadel against the entire Final Empire."
"I intend to give them a better chance than you think, Ham," Kelsier said.
If we can turn the nobility against each other and destabilize the government...
Maybe, Ham said, still not convinced.
You agreed to the plan, Ham, Kelsier said. This was what we were intending all along. Raise an army, deliver it to Yeadon.
I know, Ham said, sighing and leaning back against the cavern wall. I guess... Well, it's different now that I've been leading them. Maybe I'm just not meant to be in charge like this. I'm a bodyguard, not a general.
I know how you feel, my friend, Kelsier thought. I'm a thief, not a prophet. Sometimes we just have to be what the job requires.
Kelsier laid a hand on Ham's shoulder. You did a fine job here. Ham paused.
Did fine?
I brought Yeadon to replace you. Dox and I decided it would be better to rotate him in as the army's commander. That way the troops get used to him as their leader. Besides, we need you back in Luthadel. Someone has to visit the garrison and gather intelligence, and you're the only one with any military contacts.
So I'm going back with you?
Ham asked. Kelsier nodded. Ham looked crestfallen for just a moment, then he relaxed, smiling.
I'll finally be able to get out of this uniform. But do you think Yeadon can handle it?
You said yourself, he's changed a lot during the last few months. And he really is an excellent administrator. He's done a fine job with the rebellion since my brother left.
I suppose.
Kelsier shook his head ruefully.
We're spread thin, Ham. You and Breeze are two of the only men I know I can trust, and I need you back in Luthadel. Eden's not perfect for the job here, but the army is going to be his eventually. Might as well let him lead it for a time. Besides, it will give him something to do. He's growing a bit touchy about his place in the crew.
Kelsier paused, then smiled in amusement.
I think he's jealous of the attention I pay the others.
Ham smiled.
That is a change.
They began to walk again, leaving the practice chamber behind. They entered another twisting stone tunnel, this one leading slightly downward, Ham's lantern providing their only light.
You know, Ham said after a few minutes of walking, there's something else nice about this place. You've probably noticed this before, but it certainly is beautiful down here sometimes.
Kelsier hadn't noticed. He glanced to the side as they walked. One edge of the chamber had been formed of dripping minerals from the ceiling. Thin stalactites and stalagmites, like dirty icicles, melding together to form a kind of banister. Minerals twinkled in Ham's light, and the path in front of them seemed to be frozen in the form of a tumbling, molten river.
No, Kelsier thought. No, I don't see its beauty, Ham.
Other men might see art in the layers of color and melted rock. Kelsier only saw the pits. Endless caves, most of them going straight down. He'd been forced to wiggle through cracks, plunging downward in the darkness, not even given a light to brighten his way. Often he'd considered not climbing back up. But then he would find a corpse in the caves, the body of another prisoner, a man who had gotten lost or who had perhaps just given up. Kelsier would feel their bones and promise himself more. Each week he'd found an ATM geode. Each week he'd avoided execution by brutal beating. Except that last time. He didn't deserve to be alive. He should have been killed. But Mare had given him an ATM geode, promising him that she'd found two that week. It wasn't until after he'd turned it in that he'd discovered her lie. She'd been beaten to death the next day. Beaten to death right in front of him. That night Kelsier had snapped, coming into his powers as a mistborn. The next night, men had died. Many men.
Survivor of Hathsin. A man who shouldn't live. Even after watching her die, I couldn't decide if she'd betrayed me or not. Did she give me that geode out of love? Or did she do it out of guilt?
No, he couldn't see beauty in the caverns. Other men had been driven mad by the pits, becoming terrified of small enclosed spaces. That hadn't happened to Kelsier. However, he knew that no matter what wonders the labyrinths held, no matter how amazing the views or delicate the beauties, he would never acknowledge them. Not with Mare dead.
I can't think about this anymore, Kelsier decided, the cavern seeming to grow darker around him. He glanced to the side.
All right, Ham. Go ahead. Tell me what you were thinking about.
Really?
Ham said eagerly. Yes, Kelsier said with a sense of resignation.
All right, Ham said. So here's what I've been worried about lately. Are Ska different from noblemen?
Of course they are, Kelsier said. The aristocracy has the money and the land. The Ska don't have anything.
I don't mean economics. I'm talking about physical differences. You know what the obligators say, right?
Kelsier nodded.
Well, is it true? I mean, Ska really do have a lot of children, and I've heard that aristocrats have trouble reproducing.
The balance, it was called. It was supposedly the way that the Lord Ruler ensured that there weren't too many noblemen for the Ska to support, and the way he made certain that, despite beatings and random killings, there were always enough Ska to grow food and work in mills. I've always just assumed it to be ministry rhetoric, Kelsier said honestly.
I've known Ska women to have as many as a dozen children, Ham said. But I can't name a single major noble family with more than three.
It's just cultural.
And the height difference? They say you used to be able to tell Ska and noblemen apart by sight alone. That's changed, probably through interbreeding. But most Ska are still kind of short.
That's nutritional. Ska don't get enough to eat.
What about allomancy?
Kelsier frowned.
You have to admit that there's a physical difference there, Ham said. Ska never become mistings unless they have aristocratic blood somewhere in their last five generations.
That much, at least, was true.
Ska think differently from noblemen, Kel, Ham said. Even these soldiers are kind of timid, and they're the brave ones. Yeadon's right about the general Ska population. They will never rebel. What if there really is something physically different about us? What if the noblemen are right to rule over us?
Kelsier froze in the hallway.
You don't really mean that.
Ham stopped as well.
I guess, no, I don't. But I do wonder sometimes. The noblemen have allomancy, right? Maybe they're meant to be in charge.
Meant by who?
The Lord Ruler?
Ham shrugged.
No, Ham, Kelsier said. It isn't right. This isn't right. I know it's hard to see. Things have been this way for so long. But something very serious is wrong with the way the Ska live. You have to believe that.
Ham paused, then nodded.
Let's go, Kelsier said. I want to visit that other entrance.
The week passed slowly. Kelsier inspected the troops, the training, the food, the weapons, the supplies, the scouts, the guards, and just about everything else he could think of. More important, he visited the men. He complimented and encouraged them. And he made certain to use allomancy frequently in front of them. While many Ska had heard of allomancy, very few knew specifically what it could do. Noblemen mistings rarely used their powers in front of other people, and half-breeds had to be even more careful. Ordinary Ska, even city Ska, didn't know of things like steel-pushing or pewter-burning. When they saw Kelsier flying through the air or sparring with supernatural strength, they would just attribute it to formless allomancy magics. Kelsier didn't mind the misunderstanding at all. Despite all of the week's activities, however, he never forgot his conversation with Ham. How could he even wonder if Ska are inferior? Kelsier thought, poking at his meal as he sat at the high table in the central meeting cavern. The massive room was large enough to hold the entire army of 7,000 men, though many sat in side chambers or halfway out into tunnels. The high table sat on a raised rock formation at the far end of the chamber.
I'm probably worrying too much.
Ham was prone to think about things that no sane man would consider. This was just another of his philosophical dilemmas. In fact, he already seemed to have forgotten his earlier concerns. He laughed with Yeadon, enjoying his meal. As for Yeadon, the gangly rebel leader looked quite satisfied with his general's uniform and had spent the week taking very serious notes from Ham regarding the army's operation. He seemed to be falling quite naturally into his duties. In fact, Kelsier seemed to be the only one who wasn't enjoying the feast. The evening's foods, brought on the barges especially for the occasion, were humble by aristocratic standards, but were much finer than what soldiers were used to. The men relished the meal with a joyful boisterousness, drinking their small allotment of ale and celebrating the moment. And still, Kelsier worried. What did these men think they were fighting for? They seemed enthusiastic about their training, but that might have just been due to the regular meals. Did they actually believe that they deserved to overthrow the final empire? Did they think that Ska were inferior to noblemen? Kelsier could sense their reservations. Many of the men realized the impending danger, and only the strict exit rules kept them from fleeing. While they were eager to speak of their training, they avoided talking about their final task, that of seizing the palace and city walls, then holding off the Luthadel garrison. They don't think they can succeed, Kelsier guessed. They need confidence. The rumors about me are a start, but... He nudged Ham, getting the man's attention. Are there any men who have given you discipline problems? Kelsier asked quietly. Ham frowned at the odd question.
There are a couple, of course. I'd think there are always dissidents in a group this large.
Anyone in particular? Kelsier asked.
Men who have wanted to leave.
I need someone outspoken in their opposition to what we're doing.
There are a couple in the brig right now, Ham said.
Anyone here? Kelsier asked. Preferably someone sitting at a table we can see. Ham thought for a moment, scanning the crowd.
The man sitting at the second table, with the red cloak. He was caught trying to escape a couple weeks ago.
The man in question was scrawny and twitchy. He sat at his table with a hunched, solitary posture. Kelsier shook his head.
I need someone a bit more charismatic.
Ham rubbed his chin in thought. Then he paused and nodded toward another table.
Bilg, the big guy, sitting at the fourth table over on the right.
I see him, Kelsier said. Bilg was a brawny man wearing a vest and a full beard.
He's too clever to be insubordinate, Ham said, but he's been making trouble quietly. He doesn't think we have a chance against the Final Empire. I'd lock him up, but I can't really punish a man for expressing fear. Or at least if I did, I'd have to do the same for half the army. Besides, he's too good a warrior to discard idly.
He's perfect, Kelsier said. He burned Zink, then looked toward Bilg. While Zink wouldn't let him read the man's emotions, it was possible, when burning the metal, to isolate just a single individual for soothing or rioting, much as one was able to isolate a single bit of metal from hundreds to pull on. Even still, it was difficult to single Bilg out from such a large crowd, so Kelsier just focused on the entire tableful of men, keeping their emotions in hand for later use. Then he stood. Slowly the cavern quieted.
Men, before I leave, I wish to express one last time how much I was impressed by this visit.
His words rang through the room, amplified by the cavern's natural acoustics.
You are becoming a fine army, Kelsier said. I apologize for stealing General Hammond, but I leave a very competent man in his place. Many of you know General Yeadon. You know of his many years serving as rebellion leader. I have confidence in his ability to train you even further in the ways of soldiers.
He began to riot Bilg and his companions, inflaming their emotions, counting on the fact that they'd be feeling disagreeable.
"It is a great task, I ask of you," Kelsier said, not looking at Bilg. "Those Ska outside of Luthadel, indeed most Ska everywhere, have no idea what you are about to do for them. They aren't aware of the training you endure, or the battles you prepare to fight. However, they will reap the rewards. Some day they will call you heroes."
He rioted Bilg's emotions even harder.
"The garrison of Luthadel is strong," Kelsier said. "But we can defeat it, especially if we take the city walls quickly. Do not forget why you came here. This isn't simply about learning to swing a sword or wear a helm. This is about a revolution such as the world has never seen. It is about taking the government for ourselves, about ousting the Lord Ruler. Do not lose sight of your goal."
Kelsier paused. From the corner of his eye, he could see dark expressions from the men at Bilg's table. Finally, in the silence, Kelsier heard a muttered comment from the table, carried by cavern acoustics to many ears. Kelsier frowned, turning toward Bilg. The entire cavern seemed to grow even more still.
"Did you say something?" Kelsier asked.
"Now, the moment of decision. Will he resist, or will he be cowed?" Bilg looked back. Kelsier hit the man with a flared riot. His reward came as Bilg stood from his table, face red.
"Yes, sir," the brawny man snapped. "I did say something. I said that some of us haven't lost sight of our goal. We think about it every day."
"And why is that?" Kelsier asked. Rumbling whispers began to sound at the back of the cavern as soldiers passed the news to those too far away to hear. Bilg took a deep breath.
"Because, sir, we think that this is suicide you're sending us to. The Final Empire's armies are bigger than just one garrison. It won't matter if we take the walls. We'll get slaughtered eventually anyway. You don't overthrow an empire with a couple thousand soldiers."
"Perfect," Kelsier thought. "I'm sorry, Bilg, but someone needed to say it, and it certainly couldn't be me."
"I see we have a disagreement," Kelsier said loudly. "I believe in these men and in their purpose. I believe that you are a deluded fool," Bilg bellowed. "And I was a bigger fool for coming to these bloody caves. If you're so certain about our chances, then why can't anyone leave? We're trapped here until you send us to die." "You insult me," Kelsier snapped. "You know very well why men aren't allowed to leave. Why do you want to go, soldier? Are you that eager to sell out your companions to the Lord Ruler? A few quick boxings in exchange for 4,000 lives?"
Bilg's face grew redder.
"I would never do such a thing, but I'm certainly not going to let you send me to my death either. This army is a waste."
"You speak treason," Kelsier said. He turned, scanning the crowd. "It is not fitting for a general to fight a man beneath his command. Is there a soldier here who is willing to defend the honor of this rebellion?"
Immediately, a couple dozen men stood up. Kelsier noticed one in particular. He was smaller than the rest, but he had the simple earnestness that Kelsier had noticed earlier.
"Captain Demu."
Immediately, the young captain jumped forward. Kelsier reached over, grabbing his own sword and tossing it down to the man.
"You can use a sword, lad?"
"Yes, sir."
"Someone fetch a weapon for Bilg and a pair of studded vests."
Kelsier turned toward Bilg.
"Noblemen have a tradition. When two men have a dispute, they settle it with a duel. Defeat my champion and you are free to leave."
"And if he defeats me?" Bilg asked.
"Then you'll be dead," Kelsier said.
"I'm dead if I stay," Bilg said,
accepting a sword from a nearby soldier.
"I accept the terms."
Kelsier nodded, waving for some men to pull aside tables and make an open space before the high table. Men began to stand, crowding around to watch the contest.
"Kel,"
What are you doing?
Ham hissed at his side.
Something that needs to be done. Needs to be? Kelsier, that boy is no match for Bilg. I trust Dimmu, that's why I promoted him. But he's not that great a warrior. Bilg's one of the finest swordsmen in the army.
The men know this? Kelsier asked.
Of course, Ham said. Call this off. Dimmu is nearly half Bilg's size. He's at a disadvantage in reach, strength, and skill. He'll get slaughtered.
Kelsier ignored the request.
He sat quietly as Bilg and Dimmu hefted their weapons, a pair of soldiers tying on their leather cuirasses. When they were done, Kelsier waved a hand, motioning for the battle to begin. Ham groaned. It would be a short fight. Both men had long swords and little armor. Bilg stepped forward with confidence, making a few testing swings toward Dimmu. The boy was at least competent. He blocked the blows, but he revealed a great deal about his abilities as he did so. Taking a deep breath, Kelsier burned steel and iron. Bilg swung, and Kelsier nudged the blade to the side, giving Dimmu room to escape. The boy tried a thrust, but Bilg easily knocked it away. The larger warrior then attacked with a barrage, sending Dimmu stumbling backward. Dimmu tried to jump out of the way of the last swing, but he was too slow. The blade fell with awful inevitability. Kelsier flared iron, stabilizing himself by pulling against a lantern bracket behind, then grabbed the iron studs on Demu's vest. Kelsier pulled as Dimmu jumped, yanking the boy backward in a small arc away from Bilg. Dimmu landed with a maladroit stumble as Bilg's sword smashed into the stone ground. Bilg looked up with surprise, and a low rumble of amazement moved through the crowd. Bilg growled, running forward with weapon held high. Dimmu blocked the powerful swing, but Bilg knocked the boy's weapon aside with a careless sweep. Bilg struck again, and Dimmu raised a hand in reflexive defense. Kelsier pushed, freezing Bilg's sword in mid-swing. Dimmu stood, hand forward, as if he had stopped the attacking weapon with a thought. The two stood like that for a moment, Bilg trying to force the sword forward, Dimmu staring in awe at his hand. Standing up a bit straighter, Dimmu tentatively forced his hand forward. Kelsier pushed, throwing Bilg backward. The large warrior tumbled to the ground with a cry of surprise. When he rose a moment later, Kelsier didn't have to riot his emotions to make him angry. He bellowed in rage, grabbing his sword in two hands and rushing toward Dimmu.
Some men don't know when to quit, Kelsier thought as Bilg swung.
Dimmu began to dodge. Kelsier shoved the boy to the side, getting him out of the way. Then Dimmu turned, gripping his own weapon in two hands, and swinging at Bilg. Kelsier grabbed Dimmu's weapon in mid-arc and pulled against it forcefully, ripping the steel forward with a mighty flare of iron. The swords smashed together, and Dimmu's Kelsier-enhanced blow knocked Bilg's weapon out of his hands. There was a loud snap, and the large miscreant fell to the floor, thrown completely off balance by the force of Dimmu's blow. Bilg's weapon bounced to the stone floor a distance away. Dimmu stepped forward, raising his weapon over the stunned Bilg. And then he stopped. Kelsier burned iron, reaching out to grab the weapon and pull it down, to force the killing blow. But Dimmu resisted. Kelsier paused.
This man should die, he thought angrily.
On the ground, Bilg groaned quietly. Kelsier could just barely see his twisted arm, its bone shattered by the powerful strike. It was bleeding.
No, Kelsier thought. This is enough.
He released Dimmu's weapon. Dimmu lowered his sword, staring down at Bilg. Then Dimmu raised his hands, regarding them with wonder, his arms quivering slightly. Kelsier stood, and the crowd fell to a hush once again.
Do you think I would send you against the Lord Ruler unprepared?
Kelsier demanded in a loud voice.
Do you think I would just send you off to die? You fight for what is just, men. You fight for me. I will not leave you unaided when you go against the soldiers of the Final Empire.
Kelsier thrust his hand into the air, holding aloft a tiny bar of metal.
You've heard of this, haven't you? You know the rumors of the 11th medal? Well, I have it, and I will use it. The Lord Ruler will die.
The men began to cheer.
"This is not our only tool," Kelsier bellowed. "You soldiers have power untold inside of you. You have heard of the arcane magics that the Lord Ruler uses? Well, we have some of our own. Feast, my soldiers, and don't fear the battle to come. Look forward to it."
The room erupted in a riot of cheers, and Kelsier waved for more ale to be delivered. A couple of servants rushed forward to help Bilg from the room. When Kelsier sat, Ham was frowning deeply.
"I don't like this, Kel," he said.
"I know," Kelsier said quietly. Ham was about to speak further, but Yeadon leaned across him.
"That was amazing. Kelsier, I didn't know. You should have told me you could pass your powers to others. Why, with these abilities, how can we possibly lose?"
Ham laid a hand on Yeadon's shoulder, pushing the man back into his seat.
"Eat," he ordered.
Then he turned to Kelsier, pulling his chair closer and speaking in a low voice.
"You just lied to my entire army, Kel."
"No, Ham," Kelsier said quietly.
"I lied to my army."
Ham paused, then his face darkened. Kelsier sighed. "It was only a partial lie. They don't need to be warriors. They just have to look threatening long enough for us to grab the Atium. With it, we can bribe the garrison, and our men won't even have to fight. That's virtually the same thing as what I promised them." Ham didn't respond.
"Before we leave," Kelsier said, "I want you to select a few dozen of our most trustworthy and devoted soldiers. We'll send them back to Luthadel with vows that they can't reveal where the army is, so that the word of this evening can spread amongst the Ska."
"So this is about your ego?" Ham snapped.
Kelsier shook his head.
"Sometimes we need to do things that we find distasteful, Ham. My ego may be considerable, but this is about something else entirely."
Ham sat for a moment, then turned back to his meal. He didn't eat, however. He just sat staring at the blood on the ground before the high table.
"Ah, Ham," Kelsier thought. "I wish I could explain everything to you. Plots behind plots. Plans beyond plans. There was always another secret."
At first, there were those who didn't think the deepness was a serious danger, at least not to them. However, it brought with it a blight that I have seen infect nearly every part of the land. Armies are useless before it. Great cities are laid low by its power. Crops fail and the land dies. This is the thing I fight. This is the monster I must defeat. I fear that I have taken too long. Already so much destruction has occurred that I fear for mankind's survival. Is this truly the end of the world, as many of the philosophers predict?
22.
"We arrived in Terrace earlier this week," Vin read. "And I have to say, I find the countryside beautiful. The great mountains to the north, with their bald snowcaps and forested mantles, stand like watchful gods over this land of green fertility. My own lands to the south are mostly flat. I think that they might look less dreary if there were a few mountains to vary the terrain. The people here are mostly herdsmen, though timber harvesters and farmers are not uncommon. It is a pastoral land, certainly. It seems odd that a place so remarkably agrarian could have produced the prophecies and theologies upon which the entire world now relies. We picked up a group of Terrace packmen to guide us through the difficult mountain passages. Yet these are no ordinary men. The stories are apparently true. Some Terrace men have a remarkable ability that is most intriguing. Somehow they can store up their strength for use on the next day. Before they sleep at night, they spend an hour lying in their bedrolls, during which time they suddenly grow very frail in appearance, almost as if they had aged by half a century. Yet when they awake the next morning, they become quite muscular. Apparently their powers have something to do with the metal bracelets and earrings that they always wear. The leader of the Pac-Men is named Rashik, and he is rather taciturn. Nevertheless, Braches, inquisitive as always, has promised to interrogate him in the hopes of discovering exactly how this wondrous strength-storing is achieved. Tomorrow we begin the final stage of our pilgrimage, the far mountains of Terrace. There, hopefully, I will find peace, both for myself and for our poor land. As she read her copy of the logbook, Vin was quickly coming to several decisions. First was the firm belief that she did not like reading. Sazed didn't listen to her complaints. He just claimed that she hadn't practiced enough. Couldn't he see that reading was hardly as practical a skill as being able to handle a dagger or use allomancy? Still, she continued to read as per his orders, if only to stubbornly prove that she could. Many of the logbook's words were difficult to her, and she had to read in a secluded part of Renew's mansion, where she could sound out the words to herself, trying to decipher the Lord Ruler's odd style of writing. The continued reading led her to her second conclusion. The Lord Ruler was far more whiny than any god had a right to be. When pages of the logbook weren't filled with boring notes about the Lord Ruler's travels, they were instead packed with internal contemplations and lengthy moralistic ramblings. Vin was beginning to wish that she'd never found the book in the first place. She sighed, settling back into her wicker chair. A cool, early spring breeze blew through the lower gardens, passing over the petite fountain brook to her left. The air was comfortably moist, and the trees overhead shaded her from the afternoon sun. Being nobility, even fake nobility, certainly did have its perks. A quiet footfall sounded behind her. It was distant, but Vin had grown into the habit of burning a little bit of tin at all times. She turned, shooting a covert glance over her shoulder. "Spook?" she said with surprise as young Lestiborness walked down the garden path. "What are you doing here?" Spook froze, blushing.
"Wasing with the docks to come and be without the stay."
"Doxen," Vin said. "He's here too? Maybe he has news of Kelsier."
Spook nodded, approaching.
"Weapons for the getting, giving for the time to be."
Vin paused.
"You lost me on that one."
"We needed the drop off some more weapons," Spook said, struggling to speak without his dialect. "Storing them here for a while."
"Ah," Vin said, rising and brushing off her dress. "I should go see him."
Spook looked suddenly apprehensive, flushing again, and Vin cocked her head.
"Was there something else?"
With a sudden movement, Spook reached into his vest and pulled something out. Vin flared pewter in response, but the item was simply a pink and white handkerchief. Spook thrust it toward her. Vin took it hesitantly.
"What's this for?"
Spook flushed again, then turned and dashed away. Vin watched him go, dumbfounded. She looked down at the handkerchief. It was made of soft lace, but there didn't seem to be anything unusual about it.
"That is one strange boy," she thought, tucking the handkerchief inside her sleeve.
She picked up her copy of the logbook, then began to work her way up the garden path. She was growing so accustomed to wearing a dress that she barely had to pay attention to keep the gown's lower layers from brushing against underbrush or stones.
"I guess that in itself is a valuable skill," Vin thought as she reached the mansion's garden entrance without having snagged her dress on a single branch.
She pushed open the many-paned glass door and stopped the first servant she saw.
"Master Delton has arrived?" she asked, using Doxen's fake name.
He played the part of one of Renew's merchant contacts inside Luthadel.
"Yes, m'lady," the servant said. "He's in conference with Lord Renew."
Vin let the servant go. She could probably force her way into the conference, but it would look bad. Lady Valette had no reason to attend a mercantile meeting between Renew and Delton. Vin chewed her lower lip in thought. Sazed was always telling her she had to keep up appearances.
"Fine," she thought. "I'll wait. Maybe Sazed can tell me what that crazy boy expects me to do with this handkerchief."
She sought out the upper library, maintaining a pleasant ladylike smile, inwardly trying to guess what Renu and Doxin were talking about. Dropping off the weapons was an excuse. Doxin wouldn't have come personally to do something so mundane. Perhaps Kelsier had been delayed. Or maybe Doxin had finally gotten a communication from Marsh. Kelsier's brother, along with the other new obligator initiates, should be arriving back in Luthadel soon.
Doxin and Renu could have sent for me, she thought with annoyance.
Valette often entertained guests with her uncle. She shook her head. Even though Kelsier had named her a full member of the crew, the others obviously still regarded her as something of a child. They were friendly and accepting, but they didn't think to include her. It was probably unintentional, but that didn't make it any less frustrating. Light shone from the library ahead. Sure enough, Sazed sat inside, translating the last group of pages from the logbook. He looked up as Vin entered, smiling and nodding respectfully.
No spectacles this time either, Vin noted. Why did he wear them for that short time before?
Mistress Vin, he said, rising and fetching her a chair. How are your studies of the logbook going?
Vin looked down at the loosely bound pages in her hand.
All right, I suppose. I don't see why I have to bother reading them. You gave copies to Kellen Breeze, too, didn't you?
Of course, Sazed said, setting the chair down beside his desk. However, Master Kelsier asked every member of the crew to read the pages. He is correct to do so, I think. The more eyes that read those words, the more likely we will be to discover the secrets hidden within them.
Vin sighed slightly, smoothing her dress and seating herself. The white and blue dress was beautiful. Though intended for daily use, it was only slightly less luxurious than one of her ball gowns.
You must admit, mistress, Sazed said as he sat, the text is amazing. This work is a keeper's dream. Why, I'm discovering things about my culture that even I did not know.
I just got to the part where they reached Terrace.
Hopefully the next part will contain fewer supply lists. Honestly, for an evil god of darkness, he certainly can be dull.
Yes, yes, Sazed said, speaking with uncharacteristic enthusiasm. Did you see what he said? How he described Terrace as a place of green fertility? Keeper legends speak of this. Terrace is now a tundra of frozen dirt. Why, almost no plants can survive there. But once it was green and beautiful, like the text says.
Green and beautiful, Vin thought. Why would green be beautiful? That would be like having blue or purple plants. It would just be weird.
However, there was something about the logbook that made her curious, something that both Sazed and Kelsier had been strangely close-mouthed about.
I just read the part where the Lord Ruler gets some Terrace Pac-Men, Vin said carefully. He talked about how they grow stronger during the day because they let themselves be weak at night.
Sazed suddenly grew more subdued.
Yes, indeed. You know something about this? Does it have to do with being a keeper?
It does, Sazed said. But this should remain a secret, I think. Not that you aren't worthy of trust, Mistress Vin. However, if fewer people know about keepers, then fewer rumors will be told of us. It would be best if the Lord Ruler began to believe that he had destroyed us completely, as has been his goal for the last 1,000 years.
Vin shrugged.
Fine. Hopefully none of the secrets Kelsier wants us to discover in this text are related to the Terraceman powers. If they are, I'll miss them completely.
Sazed paused.
Ah, well, Vin said nonchalantly, flipping through the pages she hadn't read. Looks like he spends a lot of time talking about the Terraceman. Guess I won't be able to give much input when Kelsier gets back.
You make a good point, Sazed said slowly. Even if you make it a bit melodramatically.
Vin smiled pertly.
Very well, Sazed said with a sigh. We should not have let you spend so much time with Master Breeze, I think. The men in the logbook, Vin said. They're keepers?
Sazed nodded.
what we now call keepers were far more common back then, perhaps even more common than mistings are among modern nobility. Our art is called ferrochemy, and it grants the ability to store certain physical attributes inside bits of metal.
Vin frowned.
You burn metals too?
No, mistress, Sazed said with a shake of his head.
Ferrochemists aren't like allomancers. We don't burn away our metals. We use them as storage. Each piece of metal, dependent upon size and alloy, can store a certain physical quality. The ferrochemist saves up an attribute, then draws upon that reserve at a later time.
Attribute? Vin asked. Like strength?
Sazed nodded.
In the text, the Terrace Pac-Men make themselves weaker during the evening, storing up strength in their bracelets for use on the next day.
Vin studied Sazed's face.
That's why you wear so many earrings.
Yes, mistress, he said, reaching over to pull up his sleeves.
Underneath his robe he wore thick iron bracers upon his upper arms.
I keep some of my reserves hidden, but wearing many rings, earrings, and other items of jewelry has always been a part of Terrace culture. The Lord Ruler once tried to enforce a ban upon Terracemen touching or owning any metal. In fact, he tried to make wearing metal a noble privilege, rather than a ska one.
Vin frowned.
That's odd, she said. One would think that the nobility wouldn't want to wear metal because that would make them vulnerable to allomancy.
Indeed, Sazed said.
However, it has long been imperial fashion to accent one's wardrobe with metal. It began, I suspect, with the Lord Ruler's desire to deny the Terracemen the right to touch metal. He himself began wearing metal rings and bracelets, and the nobility always follows him in fashion. Nowadays, the most wealthy often wear metal as a symbol of power and pride.
Sounds foolish, Vin said.
Fashion often is, mistress, Sazed said. Regardless, the ploy failed. Many of the nobility only wear wood painted to look like metal, and the Terrace managed to weather the Lord Ruler's discontent in this area. It was simply too impractical to never let stewards handle metal. That hasn't stopped the Lord Ruler from trying to exterminate the Keepers, however.
He fears you.
And hates us. Not just ferrochemists, but all Terracemen.
Sazed laid a hand on the still untranslated portion of the text.
I hope to find that secret in here as well. No one remembers why the Lord Ruler persecutes the Terrace people, but I suspect that it has something to do with those Pac-Men. Their leader, Rashik, appears to be a very contrary man. The Lord Ruler often speaks of him in the narrative.
He mentioned religion, Vin said. The Terrace religion. Something about prophecies?
Sazed shook his head.
I cannot understand that question, mistress, for I don't know any more of the Terrace religion than you do.
But you collect religions, Vin said. You don't know about your own?
I do not, Sazed said solemnly. You see, mistress, this was why the Keepers were formed. Centuries ago, my people hid away the last few Terrace ferrochemists. The Lord Ruler's purges of the Terrace people were growing quite violent. This was before he began the breeding program. Back then we weren't stewards or servants. We weren't even ska. We were something to be destroyed. Yet something kept the Lord Ruler from wiping us out completely. I don't know why. Perhaps he thought genocide too kind a punishment. Anyway, he successfully destroyed our religion during the first 2 centuries of his rule. The organization of Keepers was formed during the next century, its members intent upon discovering that which had been lost, then remembering for the future.
With ferrochemy?
Sazed nodded, rubbing his fingers across the bracer on his right arm.
This one is made of copper. It allows for the storage of memories and thoughts. Each Keeper carries several bracers like this, filled with knowledge, songs, stories, prayers, histories, and languages. Many keepers have a particular area of interest. Mine is religion. But we all remember the entire collection. If just one of us survives until the death of the Lord Ruler, then the world's people will be able to recover all that they have lost.
He paused, then pulled down his sleeve.
Well, not all that was lost. There are still things we are missing.
Your own religion, Vin said quietly. You never found it, did you? Sazed shook his head.
The Lord Ruler implies in this logbook that it was our prophets that led him to the Well of Ascension. But even this is new information for us. What did we believe? What or whom did we worship? Where did these terrace prophets come from, and how did they predict the future?
I'm sorry. We continue to look, Mistress. We will find our answers eventually, I think. Even if we do not, we will still have provided an invaluable service for mankind. Our people call us docile and servile, but we have fought him in our own way.
Vin nodded. So what other things can you store? Strength and memories? Anything else?
Sazed eyed her.
I have said too much already, I think. You understand the mechanics of what we do. If the Lord Ruler mentions these things in his text, you will not be confused.
Sight, Vin said, perking up. That's why you wore glasses for a few weeks after you rescued me. You needed to be able to see better that night when you saved me, so you used up your storage. Then you spent a few weeks with weak vision so that you could refill it.
Sazed didn't respond to the comment. He picked up his pen, obviously intending to turn back to his translation.
Was there anything else, Mistress?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Vin said, pulling the handkerchief from her sleeve.
Do you have any idea what this is?
It appears to be a handkerchief, Mistress.
Vin raised a droll eyebrow.
Very funny. You've spent far too long around Kelsier, Sazed.
I know, he said with a quiet sigh. He has corrupted me, I think.
Regardless, I do not understand your question. What is distinctive about that particular handkerchief?
That's what I want to know, Vin said. Spook gave it to me just a little bit ago.
Ah, that makes sense then.
What? Vin demanded.
In noble society, Mistress, a handkerchief is the traditional gift a young man gives a lady that he wishes to seriously court.
Vin paused, regarding the handkerchief with shock.
What? Is that boy crazy?
Most young men his age are somewhat crazy, I think, Sazed said with a smile. However, this is hardly unexpected. Haven't you noticed how he stares at you when you enter the room?
I just thought he was creepy. What is he thinking? He's so much younger than me.
The boy is 15, Mistress. That only makes him 1 year your junior.
2, Vin said. I turned 17 last week.
Still, he isn't really that much younger than you.
Vin rolled her eyes. I don't have time for his attentions.
One would think, Mistress, that you would appreciate the opportunities you have. Not everyone is so fortunate.
Vin paused.
He's a eunuch, you fool.
Sazed, I'm sorry, Sazed waved a hand.
It is something I have never known enough of to miss, Mistress. Perhaps I am fortunate. A life in the underground does not make it easy to raise a family. Why, poor Master Hammond has been away from his wife for months.
Ham's married?
Of course, Sazed said. So is Master Yeadon, I believe. They protect their families by separating them from underground activities, but this necessitates spending large periods of time apart.
Who else? Vin asked. Breeze? Doxon?
Master Breeze is a bit too self-motivated for a family, I think. Master Doxon hasn't spoken of his romantic life, but I suspect that there is something painful in his past. That is not uncommon for plantation scar, as you might expect.
Doxson is from a plantation? Vin asked with surprise.
Of course. Don't you ever spend time talking with your friends, mistress?
Friends. I have friends. It was an odd realization.
Anyway, Sazed said, I should continue my work. I am sorry to be so dismissive, but I am nearly finished with the translation.
Of course, Vin said, standing and smoothing her dress.
Thank you.
She found Doxson sitting in the guest's study, writing quietly on a piece of paper, a pile of documents organized neatly on the desktop. He wore a standard nobleman's suit, and always looked more comfortable in the clothing than the others did. Kelsier was dashing, Breeze immaculate and lavish, but Doxson, he simply looked natural in the outfit. He looked up as she entered.
Vin, I'm sorry. I should have sent for you. For some reason I assumed you were out.
I often am these days, she said, closing the door behind her. I stayed home today. Listening to noblewomen prattle over their lunches can get a bit annoying.
I can imagine, Doxson said, smiling. Have a seat.
Vin nodded, strolling into the room. It was a quiet place, decorated in warm colors and deep woods. It was still somewhat light outside, but Doxson already had the evening drapes drawn and was working by candlelight.
Any news from Kelsier? Vin asked as she sat.
No, Doxson said, setting aside his document.
But that's not unexpected.
He wasn't going to stay at the caves for long, so sending a messenger back would have been a bit silly. As an allomancer, he might even be able to get back before a man on horseback. Either way, I suspect he'll be a few days late. This is Kel we're talking about, after all.
Vin nodded, then sat quietly for a moment. She hadn't spent as much time with Doxson as she had with Kelsier and Sazed, or even Hammond Breeze. He seemed like a kind man, however, very stable and very clever. While most of the others contributed some kind of allomantic power to the crew, Doxson was valuable because of his simple ability to organize. When something needed to be purchased, such as Vin's dresses, Doxson saw that it got done. When a building needed to be rented, supplies procured, or a permit secured, Doxson made it happen. He wasn't out front, scamming noblemen, fighting in the mists, or recruiting soldiers. Without him, however, Vin suspected that the entire crew would fall apart.
He's a nice man, she told herself. He won't mind if I ask him.
Dox, what was it like living on a plantation?
Hmm?
The plantation.
Vin nodded.
You grew up on one, right? You're a plantation ska?
Yes, Doxson said. Or at least I was.
What was it like?
I'm not sure how to answer, Vin. It was a hard life, but most ska live hard lives. I wasn't allowed to leave the plantation, or even go outside of the hovel community, without permission. We ate more regularly than a lot of the street ska, but we were worked as hard as any middle worker. Perhaps more. The plantations are different from the cities. Out there, every lord is his own master. Technically, the lord ruler owns the ska, but the noblemen rent them and are allowed to kill as many as they want. Each lord just has to make certain that his crops come in.
You seem so unemotional about it, Vin said.
Doxson shrugged.
It's been a while since I lived there, Vin. I don't know that the plantation was overly traumatic. It was just life. We didn't know any better. In fact, I now know that amongst plantation lords, mine was actually rather lenient.
Why did you leave then?
Doxson paused.
An event, he said, his voice growing almost wistful.
You know that the law says that a lord can bed any ska woman that he wishes?
Vin nodded.
He just has to kill her when he's done.
Or soon thereafter, Doxson said. Quickly enough that she can't birth any half-breed children.
The Lord took a woman you loved, then?
Doxson nodded.
I don't talk about it much. Not because I can't, but because I think it would be pointless. I'm not the only scar to lose a loved one to a lord's passion, or even to a lord's indifference. In fact, I'll bet you'd have trouble finding a scar who hasn't had someone they love murdered by the aristocracy. That's just the way it is.
Who was she? Vin asked.
A girl from the plantation? Like I said, my story isn't that original. I remember sneaking between the hovels at night to spend time with her. The entire community played along, hiding us from the taskmasters. I wasn't supposed to be out after dark, you see. I braved the mists for the first time for her, and while many thought me foolish to go out at night, others got over their superstition and encouraged me. I think the romance inspired them. Karayan and I reminded everyone that there was something to live for. When Karayan was taken by Lord Devonshire, her corpse returned the next morning for burial. Something just died in the scar hovels. I left that next evening. I didn't know there was a better life, but I just couldn't stay. Not with Karayan's family there. Not with Lord Devonshire watching us work. Doxon sighed, shaking his head. Vin could finally see some emotion in his face. You know, he said, it amazes me sometimes that we even try. With everything they've done to us, the deaths, the tortures, the agonies, you'd think that we would just give up on things like hope and love. But we don't. Scar still fall in love. They still try to have families, and they still struggle. I mean, here we are, fighting Kel's insane little war, resisting a god we know is just going to slaughter us all. Vin sat quietly, trying to comprehend the horror of what he described.
I thought you said that your lord was a kind one.
Oh, he was, Doxon said. Lord Devonshire rarely beat his scar to death, and he only purged the elderly when the population got completely out of control. He has an impeccable reputation among the nobility. You've probably seen him at some of the balls. He's been in Lúthedain lately, over the winter, between planting seasons. Vin felt cold.
Doxon, that's horrible. How could they let a monster like that among them?
Doxon frowned. Then he leaned forward slightly, resting his arms on the desktop.
Vin, they're all like that.
I know that's what some of the Scar say, Dox, Vin said. But the people at the balls, they aren't like that. I've met them, danced with them. Dox, a lot of them are good people. I don't think they realize how terrible things are for the Scar.
Doxon looked at her with a strange expression.
Am I really hearing this from you, Vin? Why do you think we're fighting against them? Don't you realize the things those people, all of those people, are capable of?
Cruelty, perhaps, Vin said, and indifference. But they aren't monsters. Not all of them. Not like your former plantation lord.
Doxon shook his head.
You just aren't seeing well enough, Vin. A nobleman can rape and murder a Scar woman one night, then be praised for his morality and virtue the next day. Scar just aren't people to them. Noble women don't even consider it cheating when their lord sleeps with a Scar woman.
Vin trailed off, growing uncertain. This was the one area of noble culture she hadn't wanted to confront. Beatings she could perhaps forgive. But this... Doxon shook his head.
You're letting them dupe you, Vin. Things like this are less visible in the cities because of whorehouses, but the murders still happen. Some brothels use women of very poor but noble birth. Most, however, just kill off their scar whores periodically to keep the inquisitors placated.
Vin felt a little weak.
I know about the brothel stocks. My brother always threatened to sell me to one. But just because brothels exist doesn't mean that all the men go to them. There are lots of workers who don't visit the scar whorehouses.
Noblemen are different, Vin, Doxon said sternly. They're horrible creatures. Why do you think I don't complain when Kelsier kills them? Why do you think I'm working with him to overthrow their government?
You should ask some of those pretty boys you dance with how often they've slept with a scar woman they knew would be killed a short time later. They've all done it, at one point or another.
Vin looked down.
They can't be redeemed, Vin, Doxson said.
He didn't seem as passionate about the topic as Kelsier. He just seemed resigned.
I don't think that Kel will be happy until they're all dead. I doubt we have to go that far, or even that we can. But I, for one, would be more than happy to see their society collapse.
Vin sat quietly.
They can't all be like that, she thought. They're so beautiful, so distinguished. Elland has never taken and murdered a Ska woman. Has he?
I sleep but a few hours each night. We must press forward, traveling as much as we can each day. But when I finally lie down, I find sleep elusive. The same thoughts that trouble me during the day are only compounded by the stillness of night. And above it all, I hear the thumping sounds from above, the pulsings from the mountains, drawing me closer with each beat.
23.
They say the deaths of the Geffenry brothers were a retaliation for the murder of Lord Entrone, Lady Cliss said quietly.
Behind Vin's group, the musicians played upon their stage, but the evening was growing late and few people danced. Lady Cliss's circle of partygoers frowned at the news. There were about six of them, including Vin and her companion, one Mylan Davenplu, a young heir to a minor house title.
"Cliss, really," Mylan said. "Houses Geffenry and Tekiel are allies. Why would Tekiel assassinate two Geffenry noblemen?"
"Why, indeed," Cliss said, leaning forward conspiratorially, her massive blonde bun wobbling slightly.
Cliss had never displayed much fashion sense. She was an excellent source of gossip, however.
"You remember when Lord Entrone was found dead in the Tekiel Gardens?" Cliss asked. "Well, it seemed obvious that one of House Tekiel's enemies had killed him. But House Geffenry has been petitioning Tekiel for an alliance. Apparently a faction within the house thought that if something happened to inflame the Tekiels, they would be more willing to seek allies."
"You're saying that Geffenry purposely killed the Tekiel ally?"
asked Renee, Cliss's date. He scrunched up his ample brow in thought. Cliss patted Renee's arm.
"Don't worry about it too much, dear," she advised,
then turned eagerly back to the conversation.
"Don't you see? By secretly killing Lord Entrone, Geffenry hoped to get the allegiance it needs. That would give it access to those Tekiel canal routes through the eastern plains."
"But it backfired," Mylan said thoughtfully. "Tekiel discovered the ruse and killed Ardis and Kellens."
"I danced with Ardis a couple of times at the last ball," Vin said. "Now he's dead, his corpse left on the streets outside a Scar slum."
"Oh," Mylan asked. "Was he any good?"
Vin shrugged.
"Not very."
"That's all you can ask, Mylan? A man is dead and you just want to know if I liked him more than you?"
"Well, now he's dancing with the worms," said Tyden, the final man in the group.
Mylan gave the quip a pity laugh, which was more than it deserved. Tyden's attempts at humor generally left something to be desired. He seemed like the type who would have been more at home with the ruffians of Cayman's crew than the noblemen of the dance hall.
"Of course, Dox says they're all like that underneath."
Vin's conversation with Doxson still dominated her thoughts. When she'd started coming to the noblemen's balls back on that first night, the night she'd nearly been killed, she'd thought about how fake everything seemed. How had she forgotten that original impression? How had she let herself get taken in to begin admiring their poise and their splendor? Now, every nobleman's arm around her waist made her cringe, as if she could feel the rot within their hearts. How many Ska had Mylan killed? What about Tyden? He seemed like the type who would enjoy a night with the whores. But still, she played along. She had finally worn her black gown this evening, somehow feeling the need to set herself apart from the other women with their bright colors and often brighter smiles. However, she couldn't avoid the others' company. Vin had finally begun to gain the confidences her crew needed. Kelsier would be delighted to know that his plan for House Tikiel was working, and that wasn't the only thing she had been able to discover. She had dozens of little tidbits that would be of vital use to the crew's efforts. One such tidbit was about House Venture. The family was bunkering up for what it expected to be an extended house war. One evidence of this was the fact that Elland attended far fewer balls than he once had. Not that Vin minded. When he did come, he generally avoided her, and she didn't really want to talk to him anyway. Memories of what Doxson had said made her think that she might have trouble remaining civil toward Elland.
"Mylan," Lord Rene asked, "are you still planning on joining us for a game of Shelldry tomorrow?"
"Of course, Rene," Mylan said. "Didn't you promise that last time?" Tyden asked. "I'll be there," Mylan said. "Something came up last time." "And it won't come up again?" Tyden asked. "You know we can't play unless we have a fourth man. If you're not going to be there, we could ask someone else."
Mylan sighed, then held up a hand, sharply gesturing to the side. The motion caught Vin's attention. She had only been half listening to the conversation. She looked to the side and nearly jumped in shock as she saw an obligator approaching the group. So far, she'd managed to avoid obligators at the balls. After her first run-in with a high prelin some months ago, and the subsequent alerting of an inquisitor, she'd been apprehensive to even go near one. The obligator approached, smiling in a creepy sort of way. Perhaps it was the arms clasped before him, hands hidden inside the gray sleeves. Perhaps it was the tattoos around the eyes, wrinkled with the aging skin. Perhaps it was the way his eyes regarded her. It seemed like they could see through her guise. This wasn't just a nobleman. This was an obligator. Eyes of the Lord Ruler, enforcer of his law. The obligator stopped at the group. His tattoos marked him as a member of the Canton of Orthodoxy, the primary bureaucratic arm of the ministry. He eyed the group, speaking in a smooth voice.